Tuesday, May 1st.
This is May 1st.
Oh, it is.
And we are going to start with possible reconsideration of House Bill 3784. Committee that asked for unanimous consent to suspend the rules for the purposes of having to revoke. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the rules are suspended. Representative Rosenbaum.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider House Bill 3784.
Representative Rosenbaum moves that we reconsider the vote on House Bill 3784. Discussion. Committee members, the two parties in this particular dispute are now breaking bread as we speak. The bill may not be necessary, so we're going to bring the bill back at our request and set it on the shelf and see if they can't work this little disagreement out, and I have all hope that they will. So with that, the clerk will call the roll on the motion to reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 3784.
Representative
Backlund?
Aye.
Leonard?
Excuse.
Northley?
Yes.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Smith?
Excuse.
Walker?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye.
Donner?
Aye.
Nope.
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, we will set 3784 aside, and we will close the work session if we even open one to begin with.
You didn't open one.
Yeah, good deal. And then we'll go to open a work session on House Bill 3611.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3611, you visited last month on the 24th. It exempts from electrical license and permit requirements installation or assembly of electrical equipment by equipment vendors, full-time employees. You have several amendments on this, the most recent of which are the -3 and the -4. I have copies of those amendments if you need them.
Dash four is attached four. To the summary.
Joe, do you want to come up and...
The -3 amendments come from a work group between NECA IBW and Intel, and we had a small issue with the Grover Simmons and the printing industry, which I think we have solved at the top of the amendment, the -3s, that at first there was some language in the bill that actually said the... the assemblers would have to be full-time regular employees of the factory, but we changed that language to just say that the assemblers will have to be factory certified. So the people that will be assembling this equipment have some type of relationship with the manufacturer.
Yeah, for the record, I need to identify.
Oh, sorry, Joe Landry with NECA IBW for the record.
Thank you. Any questions of Joe? Representative Walker, did you have a question?
No, we had these -3s last time we met.
Right. Grover, are you responsible for the -4s?
Yes.
Do you want to come forward and talk about those?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Grover Simmons, representing the Pacific Printing and Imaging Association and the Independent Employer Association. The -4 amendment, I believe, captures the thrust of the initial bill if it was to clarify the existing statute. But the bill goes... quite some distance further than the printing industry is desirous of going, and the -3 amendment, which is before you, doesn't help. The -3 amendment still uses the term in line 2, factory certified, for people who are installers or assemblers, and it still uses on line 6 the word within. So that flies in the face of the practice in industry since 1980 or 81 that I've personally been involved with this subject, namely that when industrial electrical equipment is brought into the city of Portland, for example, it's installed by, put together and assembled by people who know the equipment, who are competent in doing that line of work, but they're not employees of the factory, they're not certified by the factory, and clearly they're not full-time employees of a vendor. So that phraseology is clearly something the industry doesn't wish to have in the law state of Oregon. And I phoned Graphic Arts Center this very morning to clear that up, and they are strongly opposed to requiring assemblers and installers be factory employed or certified or what have you. If they buy $1 million printing press, they're not going to hire a junkie to put it together. So I think it's a case where we ought to leave this up to industry to make those decisions on their own behalf. Now, line six of the dash three amendment, I think gets right to the nub of the question, namely installation or assembly includes wiring or other electrical work within the components. That's anathema to the people who have bought this equipment. They don't want somebody who is not familiar with the equipment tinkering with the inside of the machinery. The Dash 4 amendment, which is our amendment, simply, I thought, captured what the union was principally concerned about, namely that electrical wiring between the machine and the source of power must be installed or must be put in place. That wiring must be performed by a licensed electrician. That's been the practice over the years, and we simply endorse that. We like to see it in writing. The second concept is on line two of the Dash 4 amendment, and other electrical work between components of industrial electrical equipment that are located on different floors of a structure or located in different structures must be performed by a licensed electrician. That's the phraseology out of the union bill itself. That's the way it got in there. And we subscribe to that. That's the practice, current practice within the industry as far as we know. And that, I think, concludes my testimony. We would respectfully urge you to adopt the Dash 4 amendments. Amendment.
How did you speak to the Dash 4 or 3s?
Yeah, a couple of things I'd like to clarify. First of all, in line six of the dash threes, where it says that the electrical work within and between components of industrial electrical work, right there we're talking about what work the factory-certified installers will be doing. That's not anything that the electrical construction industry would like to come near or do that work. What we're doing is clarifying that that is the work of the factory installer. And then the rest of the paragraph there clarifies what is not the work of the factory installer. The reason why the language in Dash 4 doesn't work is because oftentimes these pieces of industrial electrical equipment are put into large hangars. And the problem that we were having, not with the printing industry, but with the automotive industry, was that in order to avoid the electrical safety law, people were actually hanging wires from the ceiling and laying them on top of the floor to not so that they weren't permanently attached. That way they subvert the electrical safety law because they don't permanently attach them to the building. That's why we had to get pretty crafty with the language here in Dash 3 and write it in this particular way. On the issue of factory certified, all these contractors that are assembling these pieces of industrial electrical equipment do have a relationship with the factory. The factory does know who's putting together their work, and for them to actually get a certification is, most of them are probably certified already. This is for the peace of mind of the purchaser and for the workers who will later be working on or around that equipment. And the dash four, actually, the way it's written, doesn't solve the problem at all because it doesn't get to those types of installations that are on the same floor. It doesn't get to the problem that we're addressing. So I urge you to move the dash threes.
I guess here's the trouble I'm having. Grover, you say, at least I hear you say, that in all likelihood we're going to put maybe some consultants out of business because they're not necessarily factory certified or employed by the factory, but they in fact do work on these printing presses or whatever they happen to be. But at the same time, the amendments that you're offering don't seem to fix the problem that IBEW and others are having with some of these setups in these warehouses. And I'm wondering if there isn't some language that we can get to allow your factory consultant or is there a term for these folks?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, they are simply independent business people. They are experienced in, we'll say, the printing industry, assembling graphic arts equipment, and they assemble equipment that's manufactured by a wide variety of manufacturers, for example. Some of them may have, in fact, worked for a manufacturer earlier on, but then I'm told they want to go into their own business, so they become an independent business person. Available to assemble graphic arts equipment. And that's the way it works in the printing industry. So putting them out of business is a different way of phrasing it, but they would certainly lose accounts because they would not be a full-time factory employee and they wouldn't be certified by a manufacturer particularly. So we don't want to limit their ability to do this line of work in the printing industry. I don't know quite how to solve his problem of having pieces of equipment hanging from the ceilings in places, automobile factories or wherever it is. I'd be willing to continue talking about that. But if the discussion would result in expanding the jurisdiction of the IBEW to cover work inside a piece of industrial electrical equipment, that's where we would have a real problem. We don't want that to be involved, and the phraseology would do that.
In the dash threes?
Chair, no, absolutely not. That's not the intention of the bill. It doesn't do that. It absolutely just the language doesn't do that.
What does the word within mean? Within a component of industrial electrical equipment. What I don't understand, if it doesn't mean working in the equipment, what does within mean? I think it flies in the face of a clear understanding of English.
Representative Kendall, again, when we say within components, that's the work of the assembler. That's the way it's written. There's an exemption in the law for installation or assembly of industrial electrical equipment. And then we say here that that work can be done by a certified installer. And then we say installation or assembly includes work wiring between electrical components. So that's the work of the installer. But it does not include the other things that are traditionally covered by the electrical safety law.
Mr. Chair, Representative Donner.
Joe, if we eliminated within and on six, just said electrical work between components, how would you feel about that?
Chair Canope, Representative Donner, it actually would. It wouldn't. I don't think it could work that way because we're talking about we're talking about what we're going to allow the representatives of the manufacturer to do. And if we take that out, then no longer would the representatives of the manufacturer be able to do the work within the components. And then it would apply to the electrical safety law. If you took that, if you took that word out, then indeed electricians would have to do that work.
As you're talking about the between presses, between components, so at that point you're saying that they're essentially these consultants or whoever no longer necessary, that by electrical code those have to be done.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that sentence, what that sentence says, that line 5 and 6, is what work can the certified factory installer do? That first paragraph, which says they can do wiring and other electrical work within and between components of industrial electrical work. And then the following part of the paragraph says what they cannot do.
I could just clarify, maybe I'm not tracking this, but if you look at the bottom of page 2, the language is that a license or permit is not required for the installation and assembly of the type of work that then is described in this amendment, right? The installation or assembly definition is modifying this 8, paren A, that says a license or permit is not required for the installation or assembly of. Because you're deleting lines 1 through 10 on page 3. So your new language.
Right.
Starting with electrical equipment actually is describing what a permit is not required for.
Chair Knope, Representative Rosenbaum, that's right.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Simmons, isn't that really the concern that you're expressing, is that you think people would have to be permitted to do that work?
Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I don't believe it is. We don't want the union to determine who's going to do the assembly and putting together of industrial electrical equipment. And whether you have a permit or no permit doesn't affect that. The reason that the Dash 1 amendment had that language in there, a license or permit is not required, I thought that was what the union wanted. I took it out of the Dash 4 amendment. Mr. Brewer objected to that the other day, so I took it out of the Dash 4 amendment and made what I thought was the cleanest, simplest amendment possible. It defined the fact that the union will have, a licensed electrician must be employed to make the connection between the machinery and the source of power at the wall. A licensed electrician must be employed if you go through the ceiling, the floor, the walls, all that traditional line of work, but don't touch the machinery. That's what we're trying to write, and I admit it's not easy to do, but that's what we're trying to get to.
Well, Mr. Chair, it seems like both of you are trying to satisfy each other's concerns, but you're just not interpreting the language that each of you has come up with the same way, and it would be unfortunate to have to mediate this one. It seems like you should be able to just figure out something that satisfies both of you.
Yeah, I think I would like to move this bill today, but I still have some concerns about the language based on Grover's testimony. I don't want to send out an incomplete or something that we're uncertain as to what it means. So I think we need to have a little confab with legislative council and the two of you and maybe a couple of us and see if we can't get this thing worked out. And because I think you are trying to, I don't sense anybody's trying to gain an advantage over the other, but this language doesn't seem like we're quite there yet. So let's see if we can take one more shot at this and we'll bring it back again and let's set up the appointment with LC and see if we can't get everybody's agreement on what the words actually mean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll define is and within.
Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 3611. We're going to skip over 3441. We're not going to hear that today. Amendments are not ready. Open a work session on House Bill 3171.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3171 is the fourth of four farmworker housing bills that come out of the Interim Task Force on Farmworker Housing. This is the bill that has to do with the siting of farmworker housing and needed more extensive work than any of the others. Senator Castillo has had a work group putting together the Dash 2 amendments, which you have.
Oh, wow.
Those are the only amendments that I know of. Just work session.
I should know that, shouldn't I?
How about if we have LCDC and the good people from the housing department come on up and talk about maybe something that somebody agrees on, maybe, huh?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Refine Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. We're just here to tell you we really like this amendment, so you don't have to have a replay of what you just had. As stated by the staff, Senator Castillo has been leading a work group of people trying to iron out the languages that you now find in the Dash 2 amendments. I'm sure that LCDC representative will speak to those amendments, but generally, the issue is how can we better define both urban and rural settings when it deals with farm worker and migrant worker families, and the essence of the amendments that are in front of you today creates that opportunity, so we treat farm workers and farm workers' family in the same regard and respect that we treat anybody else that's using our land use laws relative to location of permanent or temporary residence. And so that's the essence of what the amendment is, and from our department, who deals with farm worker housing, both permanent and temporary, this is a major change in state policy, which I think will help tremendously in the opportunities for farm worker housing to be located around the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Eber. I'm the Farm and Forest Land Specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. The testimony that we have presented in working with the work group, we are in support of House Bill 3171 with the Dash 2 amendments. As Mr. Repine has pointed out, it is a major step forward in clarifying some of the provisions for farm worker housing in both urban and rural areas and eliminates some unnecessary distinctions between year-round and seasonal farm worker housing, which have led to confusion and unneeded delays in providing that type of housing. The guts of the bill, the amendments are large, really can be found on pages 1 through 5. Essentially, in the urban areas, the bill amends Oregon's policy with regard to needed housing and ensures that housing for farm workers will be treated on the same equal footing with other single-family and multifamily housing, and that language is found in sections 2 and 3, pages 1 to 4. In the rural areas, we've had a mix of policy and rules and statutes that have distinguished between seasonal farm worker housing and year-round farm worker housing, as well as other accessory farm dwellings for farm workers. And the bill's approach is to eliminate that distinction and direct LCDC to revise its current rules dealing with accessory farm dwellings to ensure that they will also work for all types of farm worker housing. And then the rest of the bill essentially goes through and eliminates that distinction between seasonal and year-round farm worker housing in policy and statute. And gets us to a point we take that separate listing of the use in the exclusive farm use zone and we repeal it, and then we direct LCDC to revise its rules to provide for seasonal for farm worker housing by the farmer on the farm. And then essentially the rest of the amendments, 6 through pages 52, are conformance amendments that where we have eliminated those distinctions and those policy definitions and rearranged everything with legislative council. So we are in support of the bill, There's been a broad array of interest groups that have worked on this. Bob Rindy is here, who can answer, from the department, who can answer questions on the urban side. And then, of course, Senator Castillo, who has led the work group admirably.
Thank you, Senator Castillo. Can you tell us a little bit about the work group? And
okay, I will.
Up to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am very happy to be before you today with a proposal that everyone has signed off on that was involved in our work group. And we had a very wide variety of people. All of the players who would have an interest in this legislation were at the table, and we all worked quite hard for a number of months, actually, on this proposal, and finally have finished it and have brought something forward today. I will say that we really were trying to get at the issue of how we could try to remove the obstacles to the development of farm worker housing in our state by taking a look at what our land use laws are, what regulations are, and how we could tweak our regulations in a way that still provided all of the benefits that we have through those regulations to still move forward, but try to figure out how we could help remove some barriers. And so it was important to have all the parties at the table so that all the various voices who have an interest in this were there to raise. Once you took a look at one little part of our land use laws, then, you know, there would be someone else at the table who would say, yeah, but if we do that, this will happen. And, of course, the folks here from LCDC were really very, very helpful and guided us through all of that as well. But I feel very good about this. I will say that some of the members of our work group feel that this does not go far enough. They really did want us to make this a stronger bill and having more of an impact on the local government's process when these projects are proposed. But my concern about going too far in that direction was that then we would end up with some strong opposition to this, and really wanted to make this something that we could all put our arms around and embrace and support. So that's what we have before you today. And Bob Lindy can talk about the parts of it that deal with the community-based housing and how we have made some changes in the bill regarding that.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And really quickly, the amendments that we are proposing that would try and remove obstacles to farm worker housing within urban growth boundaries, within urban areas, where the bulk of multifamily housing is built. You can find those on page 4 of the amendments. This is section 3. First of all, currently farm worker housing is one of the several what we refer to as needed housing types, meaning that each urban area has to determine an amount of that of land that's needed within their urban growth boundary for these needed housing types, and then has to zone the land and provide for clear and objective approval standards for approval of housing types on that land. So that what that's meant over the last 20 years is there is an awful lot of multifamily land that's been put and zoned in urban growth boundaries due to these requirements. And when a developer comes to the zoning counter, the requirements for approval of that have to be clear and objective. There's no, you can't use, cities aren't allowed to use standards that have enough, so much discretion that somebody wouldn't know what it is they have to meet before they go into the hearing. These provisions were already applicable to multifamily housing. We've taken it a step further, and now the proposal here is that any place where multifamily housing is allowed, then the farm worker housing would have to be allowed, and any requirements or conditions of approval that are applied to multifamily housing would be applicable to this housing as well, but cities would not be allowed to impose additional requirements on farm worker housing that they don't impose in general on multifamily or single family housing within the urban areas. And then finally, just a quick comment on Section 2. There's a couple of things that happen in Section 2. One of them is simply to remove the seasonal terminology. In fact, we've removed that throughout the bill. There's another thing here that may raise some eyebrows as this bill moves through, and that is the changing of the word shall to may, for example, on page 3, on line 23. I don't know whether this is one of those committees that's already had the discussion with Ledge Council that may means shall, and this is not a change in policy, and I want the record to be clear. That's our understanding as well, that this is simply more for grammar. It is not a weakening of that requirement, and I trust cities and others won't view it in that way. And with that, I'll be glad to take any questions.
We have had a discussion with Legislative Council. I think it's more for employment of attorneys than anything else. Because I can't figure out the reason why we keep switching back and forth, but it seems to be cyclical. So, any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you. A piece I'd like to clarify is in the summary of the bill, where it talks about the changes made, I think it asks it to be addressed in rule on the farm. Can a farmer put additional housing on the farm to accommodate workers? Do those have to be farm workers under the way that it's restructured?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, yes, they would. The existing rules that we have require that there be a demonstration that the farm operator requires or will require a certain amount of assistance on the farm to justify the farm worker housing. And that's in the existing rules, and we would continue that in this context.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. We really appreciate your patience and your work on this particular amendment to this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you.
Any other of the work group wish to testify in their avid support for this? And is there anybody here from cities and counties? You guys want to come up and give us the big high sign?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don Schoenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Yes, offering our enthusiastic support for 3171. I would like to, again, compliment Senator Castillo and her leadership of this working group. Also, Mr. Repine for his ability to get us to think outside the box on this one. I remember especially when he asked the telling question, why do we cite farm worker housing for seasonal farm workers different than when we do for any other farm worker? And kind of ding, I don't know why we do that. Well, of course, the answer was because the law does provide for another way, and that's kind of where everybody automatically went, but for no really good reason. They are farm workers and important to the agriculture community, and we see no reason not to cite their housing the same as we would any other farm worker. So again, we offer our support for House Bill 3171.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dave Barenberg, and I'm representing the League of Oregon Cities, and we too would like to give our thumbs up and support to 3171, and also echo Mr. Schoenberg's comments in lauding the work of Senator Castillo and bringing everyone together. And also, I think we all got yet another lesson in when you're dealing with the land use laws, is changing one word just sort of starts the dominoes tumbling for miles beyond. So also Ledge Council for their work and just having words that say what we meant and don't make other unintended consequences. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. We also were a participant in the work group, and I might say we met several months, almost weekly, and have seen lots of paper with regard to this subject. We appreciate the work of Senator Castillo and the other members of the work group. We support the -2 amendments to House Bill 3171 and would urge you to support it also.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify on the amendments to House Bill 3171?
Is it 4171. We've known for a long time that former Representative Repine was outside the box, and he's taken other people with him. Turned a half-page bill into 52 pages. I congratulate you on your work there. Very impressive. Seeing no other questions or anyone else wishing to testify, we need a motion on the dash two amendment.
Are you in a work session?
We are in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Leonard.
I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3171.
Representative Leonard moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 3171. Is there discussion?
Yes.
Representative Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a rather large amendment, but I appreciate all the work. And I just want to say how impressed I have been this session with the work from the Housing and Community Services Department. They are really an awesome agency. And I have to think that some of that comes from Mr. Repine formally serving this body. I don't know. I hope we bring skills to other jobs that we do after we leave here. But I've been very impressed with the work, the session, and also with the work of Senator Castillo and work group on this bill.
Any other discussion on the amendment? Any objection?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Leonard.
I move House Bill 3171 to the floor as amended with the attached recommendation.
Representative Leonard has moved House Bill 3171 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the bill. Again, we wish to thank all those who participated, Senator Castillo being chief among them, for her patience and forbearance in trying to get this to its conclusion, because it was a very daunting task. I think everybody recognized that at the beginning of session. Some of us believed that maybe it wasn't even possible, but we'd give an attempt anyway. And it has happened, and we appreciate everybody's participation. Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Leonard?
Aye.
Merkley?
Aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Walker?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye.
Donner?
Aye.
Sagamore?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye. Having received a required number of votes, House Bill 3171 as amended is sent to the floor. The due pass. Is there a volunteer carrier, or should we put this on the consent calendar? We need a carrier.
Unless you want
to. Somebody wish to carry? Yeah. I think it's an important issue that we'll need a little bit of discussion.
I'd like to carry it, if nobody else wants to.
You would like to?
Yeah.
You want to?
Yeah.
Well, you have to? Let me ask. Speak up.
I'll carry the bill, Mr. Chair, and I'll expect Representative Leonard to stand up and speak to it as well.
Well, just to make sure that happens, we'll make Walker the carrier and the Representative Leonard the co-carrier, and that way we'll insist upon his presence and his voice on this bill. And with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3172.
Yeah.
3171.
We were paying attention.
Yes.
On the floor today.
Okay.
That's right.
Now we're going to hear my bill.
Now can we hear my bill? It's all about us.
Representative Wilson, are you ready with your bill?
We have a cat right here.
Yeah.
I think we need to have a caucus.
A little caucus.
We're going to do one more work session.
Okay.
Open a work session on House Bill 3043.
Mr. Chairman, the House Bill 3043 requires building designers to register. It has a number of other provisions, which I shall not describe. Mr. Black.
What?
Gentlemen.
Okay. Wilson, what are you trying to do? You may not?
Sorry, it was so loud. I could be. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have for you today the dash two amendments, and as I recall last time when we heard this bill, there was concern that this was not descriptive enough of what we are referring to here. And so with the inclusion of the amendments, this will indicate to you what one who is going to be required as a building designer is going to have to register for, what activities that he or she can do. It also tells us those areas that an individual does not have to be a building designer to. With that, I might just introduce my friend Leon Oliver from Grants Pass, who may have some additional comments on the dash amendments.
Chair Knopp, members, these do the housekeeping that clarifies quite well what we discussed when we discussed this bill the last time, and I'm really here just to answer any questions or address any concerns you may have.
Representative Wilson, I have dash twos, but I also have dash threes. Do you know who the proper of the threes are?
I don't have dash twos, but I noticed that Mr. Oliver has dash threes.
Yeah, that's
one of those. You want to take credit for the dash threes?
Oh.
Yeah,
I'm sure, Mr. Oliver would. I'm just trying to.
I have dash two. Oh, yeah, I do.
Three?
Two and three.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
The dash threes are what Mr. Oliver would like to talk to you about. Mm-hmm. Would answer any questions.
Okay. This should be in this one.
Yeah, this really just refers to the buildings that are exempt under the architects and engineers laws now, and these are the buildings that that building designers are currently in the practice of designing. So this would be consistent with the other statutes.
I'm confused.
Me too.
Representative Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm confused. Which ones are you specifying to now, the dash two or the dash three?
Dash three.
Dash three. Okay.
Other questions for Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 671.030 subparagraph 2 and 672.060, which are in the dash three, what do those actually say?
Yeah.
Yes, I can address that.
Okay.
Yes, in 671.030, you will notice that the single family residences are mentioned there. And you'll also find farm buildings, garages, additions, sheds, shelters. So, as I understand this, individuals will be able to continue to do those without being registered as a building designer. This bill is going to deal with all other buildings beyond that. So in other words, a person can still do work on single-family residences, farm buildings, garages, additions, sheds, shelters for livestock, and so forth, without having to be a registered building designer. But if you're going to do anything beyond
that,
go ahead.
No, I'm
go ahead.
Sure, it's not.
We needed to get our stories together.
Yeah. what these two statutory sites refer to is the language for exempt buildings, which is one and two family dwellings, farm buildings, and commercial buildings with no greater than a 4,000 square foot footprint and no higher than 20 feet from the lowest finished floor to the highest finished ceiling. Those buildings are exempt from the practice of architecture or engineering in Oregon. And what this bill intends to do is folks like myself that are in the practice of designing buildings, not just someone designing their own home or someone, that as an accessory to their farming operation builds a pole barn, but those of us that hang out a shingle and say, I'm a building designer and I'm here to design your home or your office building, we need to be registered with the division and have some mandatory continuing education on codes and that kind of thing.
Representative Walker.
Mr. Chair, I was looking at my notes from the last meeting that we had. I remember we had a little bit of an embarrassing moment for Cindy Robert when she talked about these people weren't educated. She said that she did not say that, but she said you guys were going to try to work out it. You're remembering that. You're trying to work out a compromise, so I just want to know, was she involved in the development of the dash threes, and is she okay with
I don't think she was. These basically came from me.
Not in the room today.
No. After the last session, the last discussion here, she said that she was going to be opposed to it, and she felt that we should be registered under the Architect Examiner's Board. I didn't go into further discussions with her about how we'd restructure that board.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Knopf. Is there a fiscal on the dash three amendments? I see it for two, but I don't see it for three.
No, I can't address that. I don't know. Maybe
Representative Wilson could.
I'm sorry. I don't know. I'm just familiar with the one fiscal that we do have.
Actually, we had a fiscal on the original and on the dash twos. Mm-hmm. And it didn't change on either account. Essentially, it remained the same. So
assume it's the same.
This is Stembridge, and my guess would be that it would remain equally the same, the dash threes, since the dash threes are similar to the dash twos.
It looks like the dash three is very minor modifications, so it looks like, I don't want to do legislative fiscal's work for them, but it looks like that if we were to get a fiscal on the dash three, it would be very similar to what we got on the dash two.
Okay, thank you.
Does everyone have a copy of the fiscal on the dash two? I have extras of that.
Yeah. I got it. Maybe I do have. Yes, I have. Hi, Mr. Nope. Didn't need any more paper. Thank you.
Any other questions for our witnesses? Representative Merkel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under subclause 3, it appears that the dash 3 amendment takes out the exception for people who are serving as a general contractor, who have three or more years as a general contractor. What is the thinking about taking out that exception?
Well, actually, the intent was never to put in specifics like that. The director of the division is to determine what the qualifications are for registration. The way that the bill was originally drafted, it would mandate that to be a building designer, you had to work as a general contractor for 3 years, period, and would take out any education or other qualification.
Mr. Chair, clarification. The way I read it, it says the department, this is subsection 3A, shall by rule establish a registration system for building designers, which could include lots of things. But then it appeared to say the department shall allow any person who has three or more consecutive years of experience as a general contractor to register. I mean, the department has to provide for people who have that experience, regardless of other education or other provisions the department might establish. So now if we just go to the straight system of a registration system established by rule, we really don't have any sense of what we'll end up with here, whether we'll end up with a system where you have to have numerous years of experience, whether or not your experience or whether your experience as a building contractor will count for anything. It's my impression, at least, that this grants the department the ability to set the requirements for what a person has to do to be registered, and thereby who can and cannot prepare plans for one and two family dwellings and the other things that are under 671.030, which I'm still a little confused about what that list is. But do we want to just hand over that sort of carte blanche power to the department to decide who can work and who can't?
Myself and my peers are comfortable with it. I was involved in some work last year with it's actually the Building Codes Division of the department, and I don't think there were any rules written that weren't discussed in the work groups and agreed upon by consensus. So we're fairly comfortable with it, as long as the rulemaking process is a public process.
Okay, thank you.
So Other questions?
Mr. Chair, if it makes a difference to the committee, I would certainly not mind staff reading those two statutes to us to refresh our memories on what those are. Thank you. Only the pertinent section. Paragraph 2 on 671030 and paragraph 10 on 672060. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to do that?
Absolutely.
I'm reading from paragraph 2 of ORS 671.030. It says, nothing contained in ORS 671.0102, 671.220 shall prevent any person from making plan specifications or supervising the erection, enlargement, or alteration of a building or any appurtenance thereto if the building is to be used for a single-family residential building or a farm building or is a structure used in connection with or auxiliary to a single-family dwelling or farm building, such as a three-car garage, barn, shed, shelter used for the housing of domestic animals, livestock, etc., nor shall anything in ORS 671.010 to 671.220 prevent any person from making plan specifications or supervising the erection, enlargement, or alteration of any building or any appurtenance thereto where the building has a ground area of 4,000 square feet or less and is not more than 20 feet in height from the top surface of the lowest flooring to the highest interior overhead finish of the structure. Was that just one sentence?
Sorry, could you read that again?
Thank you, Embridge. That was well done. Well,
I would be happy to. Now, would you like to hear the other paragraph?
Yes. It is shorter.
It's identical.
It is shorter. And what was the site on it? It was 0.060 paragraph 10. 672.060. And what was there a subparagraph on it?
10.
Subparagraph 10.
10. It's a little bit shorter. This is 672 is in the architect. It requires licensure for architecture. So this says a.
Actually, 671 is.
And this says this section does not apply to. Mm-hmm. That's what the introduction is. And then number 10 is a person making plans specifications for supervising the erection or enlargement or alteration of a building or any appurtenance thereto if the building is to be used for a single family residential dwelling or farm building, whereas a structure used in connection with or auxiliary to a single family residential dwelling or farm building, including but not limited to a three-car garage, barn, shed, shelter used in the housing of domestic animals or livestock, period. Nothing in ORS 672.002 to 672.325 shall prevent any person from making plans or specifications for or supervising the erection, enlargement, or alteration of any building or any appurtenance thereto where the building has a ground area of 4,000 square feet or less and is not more than 20 feet in height from the top surface of lowest flooring to the highest interior overhead finish of the structure.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for asking.
That's what I thought it
said. Thought the committee could stand some clarification.
That clears everything up.
Now, are there any questions?
Well,
Representative Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the fiscal, and if I'm reading this correctly, this program is pretty self-supported because the other funds of $382,000, $360,000 of that comes from registration fees. So that leaves about $22,000 coming from someplace else. Not sure where. Maybe the representative can answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I am not able to answer that. Presumably, we fall back to a general fund when it's not met by a
22,000.
Yes.
Okay.
Let's see if there's an excess of revenues here.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify on amendments to House Bill 3043? Seeing no one else, take a motion.
Sure.
Yeah, Representative Leonard.
I would move the -3 amendments to House Bill 3043.
Representative Leonard moves the -3 amendments to House Bill 3043. Any discussion on the amendments? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Leonard.
House Bill 3043. As amended, the report will be passed recommendation.
We may want to go to Ways and Means with that first.
I move House Bill 3043 to the Committee on Ways and Means with the passed recommendation.
That's fine.
Yes. That was certainly not my intent. I didn't think I was going there, but...
Okay.
But...
Just based on the fiscal...
If you choose, that's fine. It's the chair's call.
All of the bills in the past, we've sent them the ways and means with that type of fiscal.
Yeah, that's fine.
I mean, I...
Yes.
Okay. Although it is another fund. It is another fund, so...
That's why I didn't understand why it would go.
No, it doesn't distinguish.
It still has to go for them to sort it out.
As I know.
Well, they just, yeah.
It could go from the Senate side. Would you like to make the original motion?
I do whatever you want.
Hey, Representative Leonard, will you withdraw your other motion?
I'll withdraw it. I'd move House Bill 3043 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Leonard. Representative Leonard moves House Bill 3043 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
So I want to ask the bill sponsor, my colleague next to me, a question here. Is it the overall intention that the department will set fairly strict standards for who can design buildings? I mean, is that the guts of this building bill? Are we going to exclude a bunch of people who have been designing buildings as a... may not have the years of education or other things and yet provide a good service, that since there isn't an organization, I'm afraid that there may be a lot of people around the state who may not be aware of this, but without whose livelihood we may be impacting here without their input, and I'm kind of have a little concern about that.
Yeah, I really don't know how to answer it other than to tell you that the prime issue here is building safety, and as I have talked to the individuals who care about this over time, it has been the fact that it has been some concern to them that individuals have been involved in designing family dwellings who are not well practiced in building design, and their product may not stand the test of time. And as to what standards the agency will develop and adhere to in doing this, I think the proponents of this have trusted them to be reasonable about it. They felt reasonably safe about doing that. But again, as far as the general public and those who may not initially qualify as building designers, I really don't know how to answer that beyond the overriding issue being one of building safety.
Further discussion? So, we have something to add to our
representative to know. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator at the Building Codes Division. I sense a certain angst around the rulemaking process. Would just like to state for the record that the rulemaking process is conducted at the division since I've come in to my position involve advisory committees, which will have representatives of consumers, representatives of the individuals involved in this practice, as well as the rest of the industry. And they will be an open public process, as is required by the Administrative Procedures Act. So we, contrary maybe to popular belief, we don't do any of this under the table. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have a question for Mr. Brewer while you're here. I have this letter from you. And it says, staff at the Building Codes Division expressed the belief that the marketplace seems to be an adequate filter, eliminating those who repeatedly provide poor or inadequate plans. Since I didn't follow up and talk with you about this, is it your impression we're solving a problem that doesn't exist? Because I think it's really, your letter says earlier that it's really the homeowners that are repeatedly the problem, and this bill doesn't address homeowners. Homeowners can still design their own homes. And are we solving a problem, or are we just creating more bureaucracy?
Chair Canope, Representative Merkley, as I recall the question and the answer, it was actually a little bit broader than that. The answer to the question was that we had contacted a number of jurisdictions who indicated to us that they didn't track information on this issue in that context. When we say that the marketplace acts as a filter, that means to me that over a period of time, those who aren't skilled at this, those who do this poorly, go by the wayside. Now, there are a number of consumers, a number of folks that interact with those individuals during that time who may not be satisfied with the product, may suffer some consequence as a result of the fact that the person they were working with really didn't know what they were doing. The division is neutral on this bill, but I believe it will provide consumer service in simply knowing who is registered and is a professional in this field.
One more question, Mr. Chair.
Another question.
Is it your sense then that this that we'll really end up with a registration process? When I first thought registration, I thought fill out the form and you're registered. But then when I saw the design of registration process, it sounded like, is the intention, do you envision that what would happen with this is that you would set standards for who's able to register and who isn't, this much education, this much experience, so on and so forth? Or how do you envision this working?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, in other areas where the division provides certification, it's been our approach to provide multiple paths to qualifying for that certification, either through formal education, college degree, through experience on the job site, through work that may be relevant to this particular field. I'd expect that we'd come up with a similar multiple path approach to qualifying for being a part of this registry. I don't expect that the bar would be exceedingly high, however, because I believe you've hit the mark when you, your registration is something that's not as difficult to get as certification and not as difficult to get as license. So it is the lowest level of regulation that the state might provide.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions for
Mr. Chair, just a comment. We're in work session now.
We are.
And I'm going to support this bill. I have qualms about it because but upon hearing the bar won't be set too high, this is registration is different than certification. And I feel the ultimate test is consumer satisfaction. I can't detect that we have a big problem now, but it seems reasonable that we register people involved in this area. And I'll support the bill, and I hope the hearings process is able to be publicized in a way that those who exercise this profession find out about and participate in helping decide how it works out.
Any discussion? Seeing no one else, clerk will call the roll on our motion to send House Bill 3043 to the floor.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Walker?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye.
Rahner?
Aye.
Basham?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Nope.
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 3043 is sent to the floor. Representative Wilson, would you like to carry the bill?
I will.
Representative Wilson will be the carrier, and we will close the work session for House Bill 3043, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3965. Representative Walker.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3965 would prohibit merchants from selling essential goods or services at unconscionably excessive prices during a state of emergency or abnormal disruption of the market declared by the governor. It defines unconscionably excessive as prices more than 20% higher than normal unless the increased price is attributable to costs paid to suppliers. It defines abnormal disruption of the market as a man-made or natural event that causes essential goods or services not to be readily available. Provides that the violation is an unlawful trade practice.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, Vicki Walker, State Representative for House District 41. Seated to my right is Eugene Ebersole, Assistant Attorney General with the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. And he'll be talking to you a little bit about this bill today as well. I have co-sponsored this bill with the good Senator Courtney. I thought that with all of his earthquake preparedness bills this session, he might be interested in what we do in the event there is an earthquake or some other calamity. And actually, Oregon is looking at facing a pretty severe calamity in the eastern part of the state with the drought and the water situation. This bill comes to you because I was concerned about what happened in Seattle with their major earthquake and thinking about what could happen in Oregon. And so I thought maybe we needed to be ahead of the eight ball instead of behind it. This bill actually was, there was a similar bill to this in the 93 session, Senate Bill 1117. This bill is remarkably different from that in that we are not, we took away the criminal penalties and cleaned it up. That bill got hearings toward the very end of the session, not quite as long. Well, this one is not quite as long as that. It was like late May and early June, so the bill did not come out of the Senate, though it passed from one committee to another. I think it's an interesting concept. I think it's a good concept, and I'm going to let Mr. Ebersole talk to you about it a bit.
Chair Knope, members of the committee, I'd like to apologize for my typographical errors, first of all, in my memorandum I've submitted. I'm going to submit a corrected memorandum for the exhibit so it's cleaned up properly. I'd also, I was in a bit of a rush since we didn't know this was going to come on so fast, and I wrote this in the last hour before I came here. On page 2, line 2, the word B should be submitted after the words should not. So it should not be a response to an emergency situation. And a clean 3 copies for the exhibit. For the record, will be submitted so we have something that looks nice for my office. I don't like submitting things that are typographically incorrect.
Yeah, Mr. Ebersole, that was, I'm glad you went up to this, but it really was my office because I'm on 3 committees and we got confused about the committee. So don't feel bad. Okay, take it away.
This bill originally was conceived after the Mount Angel earthquake. I have been with the Oregon Department of Justice and Consumer Protection for 12 years, and the late Senator Roberts came to me then asking if we had some consumer protection bills that were not able to get put on the DOJ agenda, and I did have this bill put together. It was in light of the major earthquake and in response to the major earthquake of Hurricane Andrew in Florida, which probably was the biggest example of the type of scams that could occur after a natural disaster. I believe back in those days, Mr. Stembridge was the deputy administrator of the Construction Contractors Board, and we worked closely together in trying to alert people to the types of things that could occur. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act is a great tool that we have in this state to use in most cases for the types of scams that come in. The problem with price gouging per se is that the general rule of law is supply and demand, and we support that, and there's nothing wrong with that in the normal business situation. And the Unlawful Trade Practice Act has been used by our office with the Construction Contractors Board on several occasions even to stop price gouging by contractors in situations where unconscionability was a mixture of many facts and elements that took a long time to put together and to prove. The problem when you have a disaster of the magnitude of Hurricane Andrew or of a major earthquake is that the con artists and scam artists descend upon the consumers and the citizens of a state or an area, like vultures in the desert, descend upon people that are lying there dying. They're quick, they're fast, they know what they're doing, and they know how to take advantage of our consumers. Price gouging is insidious at worst, I believe, because it allows profiteers to take advantage of people when they're in their most vulnerable state, and that's our citizens. I spoke with our seismic geologist today in the state to find out if what I had heard was correct, and that is if an earthquake of the magnitude Seattle had just so few weeks ago hit Oregon, we probably would not be so lucky because our seismic activity occurs more towards the surface than towards the deep depths that earthquake occurred. Seattle was very lucky in that occurring that way because there virtually wasn't any real residential damage. The major damage was in Olympia, the Capitol Dome, as a matter of fact. Big structures that are made of brick and old mortar will come apart fast. But if a 6.5 came through the valley and hit Portland and Salem, I wouldn't want to even think about the type of damage that we've done. And We have been victims to price gouging. We have been victims to all types of consumer fraud and construction scams. And I would hate to think of us having to do a knee-jerk reaction if that event were to occur. We would all pray that it wouldn't. We would all pray that this bill would never have to be utilized. But it does allow us the opportunity to define the parameters of what price gouging consists of, to apply it solely for consumer goods and services and personal property, to give a clear guideline to the honest Oregon businesses so they know what to expect from the state if an emergency like this were to occur, and to give the Attorney General's office the tool to have a rapid response and a quick and effective means of addressing this type of problem if, God forbid, we ever had a disaster occur to us. I could explain some of the changes if you desire. The big change that the bill has now that was different before is before the bill was wrapped around the Governor's Emergency Powers Act. I'm not sure if that's the correct title of it, but it is the act where the governor gets to declare a state of emergency. That law in and of itself made a violation of the law a crime. And that's why we wound up a judiciary and it became a stumbling block so late in the session. This law, legislative council did an exceptional job. I'm really impressed because they didn't even call me or our office that I know of about how to change it. And they really cleaned it up well. They made it a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It defines, I think, very clearly the parameters of what the price increases could be. It defines very clearly the fact that if a business incurs these additional charges due to the calamity or due to market factors that have nothing to do with the calamity, for instance, something caused the price of a particular commodity to rise in Tennessee that had nothing to do with an earthquake in Oregon, that wouldn't be a price gouge. Likewise, if a business person had to reroute their goods because I-5 had a 200-foot wide gap in it and couldn't be used, and they had to drive all the way around the perimeter of the state to get the goods here, and it cost more, that would be an acceptable reason for an increase in price. So it really addresses the types of price increases that are part of the calamity and also that have nothing to do with the catastrophe and would be normal and acceptable. What it does do is it says if the price goes over 20%, it does establish a prima facie case. Doesn't mean you can't overcome the prima facie case, but the experience in the past since 1992, I believe, was when Andrew occurred. And in my memorandum, I've attached some press releases from across the country so you can see that the governments and the states and the cities across the country that have been faced with this have addressed it subsequently with price gouging type statutes. And I don't think we want to be in the subsequent mode. We want to be in the forefront of putting a tool in place so that if it happens to us, and I think it's an issue we have to worry about.
I'd also like to state, Mr. Chair, that the governor may declare an abnormal disruption of the market under Section 3 by proclamation at the request of a county governing body. So a county can make that application to the governor through the Office of Emergency Management. So it would not be unreasonable to assume that Klamath County may do such a motion down the road. And the bill also defines what essential consumer goods and services are. That's on page 3, sub 13. And then, of course, on page 2, it sets out how you determine whether there's an excessive price that's being charged. And I want you to know that if you're listening, Mr. Chamoff, it is you who drafted this wonderful bill. You have been given due credit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beckham. Thank you. Representative, you picked a figure of 20%. Why that figure? How'd you come up with that number?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beckham, I'm going to defer that question to Mr. Ebersol.
Sure.
Chair Canope, Representative Backlund.
Good question.
It is a good question, and we picked that. This bill was worked extensively by then-Senator Kennedy's committee. It was a predominantly Republican committee and was very conservative in their approach towards how we would do it. I believe the original draft, when I drafted the bill, had 10% based upon the city of, I believe it was Los Angeles, or it might have been one of the other states, but I take not total credit. I do plagiarize well from people that have done the same thing before. And most of the bills that we had seen were 10%. We thought that was too low, and we gave 20% as a guideline. There is going to be fluctuation in any commodity in any time. You know, the price of goods will go up on supply and demand, and we thought that 20%, I guess that was the consensus of the committee. It passed from, I believe, Senator Kenner's committee. This is the subsequent committee to that committee. It had a very similar name with a few different words in it, but it was the Consumer and Business Affairs Committee.
Business, Housing, and Consumer Affairs.
The bill was an engrossed bill. The original bill was worked over extensively in committee before it went to judiciary, and that was the result of negotiations and consensus, I believe. So I think that's how we got to the 20%.
Okay, thank you. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wecker, Mr. Ebersole. The enforcement mechanism that's in here calls for judicial intervention, and you talked about the timeliness with which this could take effect. So how quickly could that happen?
Chair Canope, Representative Rosenbaum, I think that this concept is so much better than the other one in that in exercising jurisdiction of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act by the Oregon Department of Justice, we have within the bill, within the act already, numerous powers for temporary restraining orders and permanent injunctions. So in the normal case scenario, for instance, we have an itinerant contractor who comes in from out of state and is unregistered. As soon as we get word of that, and we find that usually through the Oregon State Police, through the local law enforcement authorities, through the Construction Contractors Board, through the Building Codes Division, we will we'll immediately file a lawsuit with a temporary restraining order, which will freeze that business activity. That's the normal course when we have an exigent circumstance like that.
Thank you.
Chair, Representative Zahner.
Has any state that has had this law in effect had a catastrophe where they've had to apply it yet that you know of?
I have in my book. I could take out some of those. The city of Los Angeles applied a similar law when they had their flooding. Iowa, you have some news releases from the state of Iowa passed the law when they had their flooding. South Carolina has a similar law. They passed it. Florida, subsequent to Hurricane Andrew, passed a similar law.
But have they had one since they passed the law? And did they enforce it?
I think they have. The East Coast is inundated with hurricanes so much that we just don't track it. I think that the Hurricane Andrew was a key event. If you read, I put after my memorandum a press release from Attorney General Campbell of Iowa, then Attorney General Campbell. I put it there mainly because it had a quote, because the state of Florida Attorney General's office sent a small task force up to Iowa to help them, and they quoted the person from Florida quoted that they received nearly 3,500 complaints a week in Hurricane Andrew. That's something we don't want to repeat. And I don't think that luckily, we don't get disasters of that magnitude. And granted, this law would apply if we had the abnormal disruption of the marketplace. It has that advantage. But I think one of the things you have to look through this law is that there are, as Representative Merkley pointed out, and that last bill was up, there are safeguards here, numerous safeguards in that particular scenario. First of all, the local county has to apply for the abnormal disruption. So you have the local government having that tier of application. Then the governor has to approve of the application. And then finally, the attorney general's office has to review the facts and determine that it's appropriate for legal action. So in the normal disruption of the market, or the abnormal disruption of the marketplace scenario, you have three tiers of bureaucracy that have to go through this. So that's a little slower. as opposed to the other one, which is if the governor declares a state of emergency. So, I mean, I went to law school in Lewis and Clark in 1978 to 1981, and I clearly remember that fateful evening where it rained gray ash from Mount St. Helens, and many of you probably do if you were in that area. It's a scary thing when something like that happens, and we in our geographical sitting here in Oregon would hopefully never have to face a catastrophe, but I always fear, being in my position, that we might.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Walker, has the governor requested this authority, and do you know his position on the governor?
Chair Finope, no, the governor has not talked to me about this bill, and I've not talked to his office about it. So I don't know what his position is.
So on page 3, line 43, says the merchant wholesaler do not include a public body. And I'm just wondering why you exempt public bodies in ORS 3260.
Chair Knope, I would assume it's because we don't expect the public body to engage in price gouging, but perhaps Mr. Ebersole can answer that.
I regret, Chair Knope, members of the committee, I regret that I don't recall why that. And I think that probably because that was part of the emergency, somehow that might have been part of the Emergency Powers Act, and we would need a definition. Or maybe Mr. Chamberlain decided to put it. I did not sit down and carefully reread line for line on those definitions, and I probably should have. I apologize. Well,
my thought is it's probably not an accident that it's there, and if we're going to apply this to private business, I wondered why we wouldn't apply it to any public body. And so it's just a question mark in my mind, so I'm sure there's an answer to it.
I'll check with Mr. Chamoff.
Sure.
Representative Warner.
I like this bill. I like the fact that it anticipates a problem as opposed to addressing a problem. We don't do enough of that. I think in a time of crises, it's easy for folks to be taken advantage of. And I like working on things that anticipates dealing with the crisis before it happens, respectively. And so I appreciate Attorney Walker and Senator Courtney bringing this forward. I like doing things like this.
Chair Canopa, members of the committee, I did address the Attorney General with our position on this, and it is wholeheartedly supported by the Department of Justice. If you wish, Chair Canopa, I'd be glad to contact the governor's office and get their position as well.
Well, I'm sure it would be helpful
yes.
to know what the governor's office thinks on a bill that we're giving the governor more authority. Maybe he doesn't want the authority. I don't know. I mean, but I assume that they would ultimately have a position. The other question I had, would this, in your interpretation of the bill, would this apply to energy prices?
We, Chair Canope, members of the committee, the original draft actually had language do you have the original bill,
yes.
Representative Walker, that was eliminated anticipating that question. Because of the energy crisis that we're going through with the state of California and such now, the original bill talked about, let me see if I can find the language. Here it is. The original bill said, any other abnormal disruption of the market for essential consumer goods and services resulting from stress of weather, natural disaster, or other act of God, failure of shortage of electrical power or other source of energy, including but not limited to gasoline and heating oil, labor disputes, civil disorder, et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, I know in this particular version on page 3, line 40, it does list utility and transportation emergencies, and I don't know I suppose bankruptcy of BPA would likely be a utility emergency. But I don't think we've gotten to our energy crisis yet, but I think we're going to be there this summer.
Well, I think, Chair Canope, members of the committee, I think that that is, we're thinking of something more catastrophic and isolated, maybe perhaps, you know, oil pipeline explosion or something. I don't think we're talking about the same thing because we eliminated the language that specifically talked about energy shortages. Mm-hmm. We're talking more about something that is in a disaster type of category as opposed to the very complex issues of energy shortages, which is not what this bill is meant to address.
It seems to me the bill addresses, it's essentially short-term price caps to not allow products or goods that are critical to, you know, life in general to exceed 20% during a 20% increase during an emergency. I mean, is that generally what you're trying to get at?
Chair Canope, representatives in the committee, yes, that is exactly what I got. I can give you some examples of the types of things that happened before. In Florida, where a $9.95 piece of plywood goes up to $50 a piece. In Iowa, where a porta potty, which normally costs $50 a month, all of a sudden costs $250 a month because people don't have a porta potty, a place to go use for a lavatory.
What happens in a situation where the South Carolina wholesalers' plywood blows away in a hurricane and the commodity is hard to come by, so they're having to import it at, you know, well above a 20% price increase, and in order to even make any profit on it, they're going to have to be well over that 20% increase.
The bill addresses that. The bill, what I think is good for the to cover that is it says that it is an affirmative defense to any claim for a violation of this section that the amount charged by the merchant is, A, attributable to additional costs imposed by the merchants or wholesaler suppliers or necessarily incurred in procuring the essential goods and services during the state of emergency or abnormal disruption in the marketplace, or the result of market factors unrelated to the state of emergency or abnormal disruption in the market. So that is exactly what we contemplated, is that, you know, depending upon how widespread the emergency is, it may cost more to get the goods. And if it costs the local merchant more to get the goods, of course they can pass along that cost and still make a profit on top, over and above that. We don't want to stop. Like I said, I believe that we are true believers in supply and demand. Mm-hmm. But there comes a clear point in which somebody departs from supply and demand economics and moves into price gouging. And by setting the 20% standard, we think we've given them some latitude there, and with the other language, give them the ability to show otherwise that they should be allowed more.
Yes, Chair Canope, members of the committee, and I want to thank Representative Leonard for his comments, because this really is anticipating some catastrophe that may happen in the future, and we should be prepared for it. And I do believe the bill addresses that issue in terms of supply and demand and the marketplace doing what it needs to do. But as Mr. Abasol indicated, there is a point where it becomes excessive, you know, people leeching off others because of the circumstances. And that shouldn't be allowed in a time of emergency or abnormal disruption. And so I think we've pretty much put those safeguards in the bill so that we don't get beyond the normal market.
Other questions from the committee of our two witnesses? Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Chair, if I understand, you would like us to answer the question about line page 3, subparagraph 18, about merchant and wholesaler and applying to a public body.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Okay, and then we'll also check with the governor's office, and I'll answer those questions for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 3965? Seeing no one else, we'll close our public hearing on House Bill 3965, and we'll open a public hearing on House Senate Bill 507.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 507 exempts an employer who is temporarily in Oregon working on a public contract from Oregon's workers' compensation insurance requirements. Mm-hmm. If the employer has furnished workers' compensation insurance coverage under the workers' compensation insurance or similar laws of a state other than Oregon, this bill passed the Senate on March 13th on a vote of 27-0.
Jessica Harris and Fred Venator.
You should come up and say, thank you, Representative. Nope.
Touché. I'll just read your name here, Fred.
I've been called a lot worse.
No, I have too. So.
I am Fred Venata, appearing before you on behalf of Liberty Northwest to give you a brief background in Senate Bill 507. Oregon statutes used to provide reciprocity so contractors in other states could come to Oregon using their workers' comp coverage to work temporarily in Oregon. In the mid-1980s, when Oregon's workers' compensation rates were very high, construction jobs were very scarce, one of the there was a joint proposal by organized labor and at least one of the construction industries to repeal Oregon's reciprocity. So out-of-state contractors had to pay Oregon workers' compensation rates. We've taken a shot or two at trying to get that resolved since then as the relationships have changed. We think this bill correctly reestablishes the concept of reciprocity. An Oregon contractor, on states where there's a reciprocity agreement, and Oregon has a reciprocity agreement with about half the states, an Oregon contractor can go to another state using the extraterritorial coverage of their workers' compensation to protect their employees there. Contractors in other states can come to Oregon. The way it is now, because we don't have reciprocity on public contracts, if an Oregon contractor goes to, for example, the state of Washington to do a public contract, and their department finds out about it, the contractor may well pay workers' compensation twice, once for their employees to their Oregon insurance carrier, and once to the Washington under Washington law, and there are a few cases where that has occurred. This bill would remedy that issue, and we would encourage your affirmative action on it.
Representative Leonard.
Fred, do I correctly recall we've had a similar bill, or was it just in sessions past, or was it just dealing with private farm workers? Is something that's ringing a bell about?
Well, you and I have the same memory, Representative Leonard, and for reasons that I'm not able to explain to you, that bill didn't solve all the problems. It may be that there's a representative of the department here who may understand better than I do why our prior attempt, but we had sat in the same hearing where the farmer up in eastern Washington was working across the border.
Exactly.
That didn't remedy the problem on public contracting.
Okay, and so what we're dealing with then here, if I could follow that up, is narrowly the issue of public contracts.
That is correct.
So to the extent that we're dealing with the issues of workers that are covered in another state that are working in Oregon on private projects.
It does not affect them.
Well, I believe. Have we dealt that?
Yeah, it is my belief that problem has been resolved.
So that this is really creating some concern. You can almost say this was an oversight. Maybe we're going to hear it from. No? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris with the Associated General Contractors. It is our understanding that the private contracting issue was resolved years ago, mm-hmm. but public contracting was perhaps overlooked, but that's not, as my colleagues in the state of Washington perceive it. They, when I've talked to both my colleagues at AGC and as well as Department of Labor up there, this has been kind of a chewing issue for both states, that we've kind of, we set these barriers on public contracts. I believe even before we set them on private, I'm not sure of that, but that this has been a long-term battle, and that both sides have been pretty ardent, and that they view our willingness to restore reciprocity as movement toward their legislature dropping their barriers as well. And so this is an important step in determining and allowing that to occur. Our contractors, AGC represents 1,200 contractors who do business across state lines on a frequent basis, especially in the Portland metro area, where the state line is not an economic line. We have contractors who live in Vancouver and come over into Portland and do bridge projects or road projects and vice versa all the time. And the double workers' comp coverage is a direct cost passed onto the public, as we are forced to carry both. And we view this measure not only as a matter of increasing the competitiveness of the market, but increasing the benefit to the public, in that surely carrying workers' comp coverage is a critical part of contracting in general, but dual coverage we view is unnecessary when both states have a reciprocity agreement.
If I may add, Mr. Chairman, the bill has been to MLAC, and MLAC gave its endorsement to the measure.
My question is, Representative Watson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we don't have a pig for you to put money in, but MLAC, your acronym is Management Labor Advisory Committee, is that correct?
That is correct. Representative Walker, you are a good student.
Thank you, Mr. Vanetta. And my reading of the summary says this does not apply to any state that we don't have reciprocity with. So if we don't have reciprocity, you've got to pay the insurance.
That is correct.
Okay.